you. I will speak with you next time.
Tune into Talking Earth, a show dedicated to showcasing our local poetry scene and poetry and spoken word from around all cultures and around the world. Join hosts Stan Raphael and Michael Van Cleek on the second and third Monday of every month from 10 to 11 p.m. You can also listen to the programs anytime at kbu.fm/program/talking-earth. Thank you for joining us for our time of poetry at KBU.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Bureau of Labor and Industry's Child Care for Construction, working to provide resources and support for new journey workers and their families, in partnership with Business Oregon. More info at oregon.gov/BOLI/apprenticeship, under the link Financial Assistance for Registered Apprentices.
Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit community radio station. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle, reminding you that you can support KBOO by clicking on the red donate tab on the KBOO app or website, or by texting KBOO to 44321, or by mailing a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Today's show is about Portland's place in the nation and the world, about the possibilities of a municipal arms embargo and the debates in the courts about federal troops in the streets, about how Portlanders continue to work for peace, justice, and a better way, with the awareness that the violence wreaked in Palestine comes home to Portland and other American cities, and that law, including international and constitutional law, is a complex but still important tool to protect the inherent rights of all people. In early October, a Trump-appointed judge issued a temporary restraining order blocking federal control of any National Guard troops in Portland, noting that the president's case for sending those troops to Portland, the administration's argument that the city was the site of an insurrection that was not being controlled by local forces, was simply untethered to the facts. But in a 2-1 ruling on October 20th, a panel from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals sided with the Trump administration, blocking the temporary restraining order and allowing the deployment of National Guard pending a further ruling on the case. In their Left and the Law segment today, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker take up the legal wrangling around deployment of Guard troops, the laws cited and opinions issued by various courts, and the implications of these cases for resistance to the Trump regime and federal mobilization of the military in cities. They also discuss legal issues around tear gassing and pepper spraying of protesters at the ICE facility in Portland on the October 18th No Kings Day. To provide context for that discussion, we're going to preface the Left and the Law segment with a brief audio clip from the KABU Evening News broadcast of October 20th, with reporting from KABU's Anna Wilcox, including audio from October 18th at the Portland ICE facility, because the KABU Evening News is always an excellent source for important local information that you're unlikely to find on corporate-affiliated media. Then, in the second part of today's Old Mole, we hear about Portlanders taking action to prevent the continuation of brutal military rule abroad as well as at home. Lori Mercier talks with Olivia Catby, co-chair of the Portland Democratic Socialists of America, about the recent action by six Portland city councilors to launch a nationwide pledge of city councilors to investigate whether, within city limits, there is any manufacturing or transport of weapons bound for Israel, and any other complicity cities may have with Israel's illegal occupation, apartheid, or genocidal violence against Palestinians. Since the federal government has failed to uphold its duty to prevent genocide and uphold respect for international humanitarian law, cities across the United States are mobilizing to ensure that local tax dollars and supply chains do not support criminal warfare. We also hear excerpts from the press conference held on October 17th with Catby and Portland councilors Samir Kanal, Mitch Green, Angelita Murillo, and Tiffany Koyama Lane. That press conference also included comments from Dr. Travis Moline, who recently returned from Gaza and was interviewed on last week's Old Mole. And let me remind you that later this week, he will also be part of an event about targeting doctors in Gaza, breaking the silence. That's this Thursday, October 30th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church on Southwest 12th Avenue in downtown Portland. There will be a vigil for murdered Palestinian healthcare workers, a short film by Jan Hocken, Sumud, a doctor's report on genocide and survival in Gaza, and a talk by Dr. Moline about his experience in Gaza this past summer. You can find more information about that event and about all our segments and shows by visiting the KABU webpage for our show at kboo.fm/oldmolevarietyhour, where you can also find links to subscribe to the show and to support KABU by clicking on the red donate tab in the upper right corner of the webpage. Okay, we turn now to a clip from the October 20th KABU Evening News, followed by The Left and the Law with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker.
After the No Kings protest on Saturday, demonstrators gathered outside the ICE facility in South Portland. ICE officers were aggressive towards the festive crowd, shooting tear gas, flashbangs, and pepper balls indiscriminately, including at people who were running away. KABU's Anna Wilcox reports.
A group of a few hundred people gathered outside the McAdam ICE facility in Portland following Saturday's peaceful No Kings protest. The festive atmosphere of the daytime protest continued here, in front of the building. Loud music played from speakers across the street. People in costumes danced and shouted remarks at the officers standing on the roof. Medic and supply stations line one side of South Bancroft Street, near the building. The air smells like a mix of tear gas and barbecue. While KABU was on the scene, two small groups of right-wing protesters gathered on either side of South Bancroft Street, on the edges of the protest. After 7 in the evening, officers began assembling behind the driveway gate of the building. Protesters began warning each other that guards were coming out.
Right now, it looks like some of the officers are lining up behind the gate to the ICE facility, which is something that's pretty common when they want to move cars in and out of the facility.
The officers fired flashbangs toward the back of the crowd. They sounded like fireworks and made red sparks. Officers used pepper balls to move protesters out of the area of the driveway. They also used gas canisters to clear the road while a vehicle exited the building. Clouds of gas filled the area in front of the building. It became impossible to see the building in the areas where gas was present. The gas made it difficult to breathe and stung any place it made contact with the skin. KABU witnessed a red flashbang fired into the tear-gassed street, nearly hitting a protester in an inflatable pig costume. You could hear the sounds of a Black Hawk helicopter circling overhead. Portland Mercury reports that the gas deployment lasted for about 10 minutes. As the officers retreated back into the building, protesters in masks and goggles tried to pour water on the gas canisters. Some kicked the canisters back toward the building. Used gas canisters littered the street and the driveway to the ICE facility. KBOO talked with a veteran who was hit with a pepper ball during the event. He had a centimeter-wide round bruise on his forearm.
What happened just now?
I was standing across the street. I was past even the sidewalk. I was underneath the canopy that's got the speakers in it. And they came out because they were opening up the gate to let out a vehicle. And they let off just a barrage of stuff to clear the roads.
That was cute.
And then as they were starting to go back in, they just launched like World War III in the middle of the street. There wasn't anybody in there, but it was just nothing. And they were just firing pepper balls all around the crowd. And I took a couple hits.
And you're a veteran.
Yes.
Would you feel comfortable sharing your thoughts about what drove you to be out here today?
This is not the country that I gave 9 years of my life in service for. And I'm out here to show that I completely disagree with this. It makes me sick to my stomach what they're turning my country into. And this is not what I fought for.
As the gas dissipated from the street, protesters went back to dancing. For KBOO Portland, I'm Anna Wilcox.
On October 20th, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals put on hold a lower court ruling that kept President Trump from taking command of 200 Oregon National Guard troops. The Trump administration has said the troops are needed to protect federal property from protesters, and that having to send extra Department of Homeland Security agents to help guard the property meant they were not enforcing immigration laws elsewhere. Well, Mike, let's talk about how these cases with deployment of the National Guard are working their way through the various levels of federal and state courts and how to make sense of the dizzying array of seemingly contradictory opinions issued.
Well, the Ninth Circuit did place on hold what the district court judge did, but it's a very interesting opinion because you get the whole array of judicial responses to what's going on in this country. There is the official ruling that reverses the district court. The district court found there was no proof at all that the present government could not enforce the law. There's no need at all. And the concurring opinion is a fervent Trumpista who said basically the president does not even need to be reviewed by the courts, that he or she can do whatever the president wants to do. There's a vigorous dissent by Judge Susan Graber, who systematically goes through all the factual evidence in this case, shows that there was no way that the law that cited by the majority was not complied with, and concludes by saying, after the court asked for a hearing by all the court, a huge majority, an en banc decision, or a review of what three judges have done. She wrote, "I urge my colleagues on this court to act swiftly to vacate the majority's order before the illegal deployment of troops under false pretenses can occur. Above all, I ask those who are watching this case unfold to retain faith in our judicial system for just a little longer."
Wow. So those are sobering words, and we're certainly responding to them. Mike, there seem to be two laws that the Trump administration citing, the Posse Comitatus Act and the Insurrection Act. Can you explain how those very old laws are cited and how capacious they are, as sometimes lawyers use that term, how capacious the laws are?
Well, the Posse Comitatus Act was passed in 1878. It has ignominious beginnings, but it's really important. It was passed originally by Southerners who wanted to be able to do whatever they wanted to do in their own states without federal interference. And what it holds is that the federal government cannot be employed, nor military troops can't be employed to do normal law enforcement activities. Now, states' rights was big in the South back when the federal government was lurking over them. But now that they control the federal government, they've lost all interest in states' rights.
Was that also true during the 50s and 60s and the confrontation over federal troops in the South, over desegregation? Was this Posse Comitatus Act cited then?
Of course, yeah. They wanted to, because when Eisenhower called in federal troops, National Guards, they stoutly resisted and cited to this law. So this is the law that would keep the National Guard from patrolling the streets of Portland. But there is
so that's also a good law to cite for those who are pushing back.
Yeah, but the law relied on by the majority opinion and by the Trumpistas is the Insurrection Act of 1792. And that
even older.
It's a very old act. It's now 10 U.S.C. or United States Code, Section 12406.
Can you say that once more, Mike?
Okay, it's 10 U.S. Code, Section 12406.
Okay, got it.
So that holds to begin with, the U.S., whenever the U.S. is invaded or in danger of invasion by a foreign nation, or there is a rebellion or danger of a rebellion against the authority of the government of the United States, or, and here's the clause that's in play, the president is unable with regular forces to execute the laws of the United States. The president may then call into federal service members and units of the National Guard of any state. So that clause 3 is the one relied on by Trump.
You know, when I read the opinion that summarizes the case of the Trump administration, there were like pages and pages of incidents from June through September at the ICE facility in Portland. And it puts together a seemingly reasonable legal argument that these protests were threats to ICE officers and the facility itself. How did you read that list of incidents that was pages and pages of them?
Well, the dissent points out that it's a rhetorical trick, that the law requires that the president be presently unable. Unable to enforce the laws means something that has to be right now.
And not that things happened in June or that.
On June 5th, someone threw an object at an ICE member has very little relevance to what's going on in late September. And she in turn quoted day after day's notes from the people who were there observing and trying to enforce the laws, saying that nothing's happening, people are sitting around, walking around. There was never any real violence to speak of. There was nothing remotely dangerous to the degree that law enforcement was helpless. They required any sort of assistance, that they were, quote, unable to enforce the laws. And the other evidence presented by the government, other than a parade of horribles stretched out over 3 months and boiled down into 2 pages, was the fact that it was expensive and inconvenient. But that's, as the dissent pointed out, not the same thing as being presently unable to force the law. The fact that something is inconvenient is not a justification for allowing army troops to patrol the streets of Portland.
Now, the sanctuary city and sanctuary state policies are really in the crosshairs of the Trump administration. And in the opinion I read, it was cited as part of the inability of ICE agents working with, they were not able to enlist the police to assist them in controlling incidents at the ICE facilities. How do you see the sanctuary policies which are in force in this city and state to be drawn into this and the legal arguments they make?
Well, it's really irrelevant. I mean, they want to slam the sanctuary movement, but they don't show how that in any way interferes with the ability of law enforcement to enforce the laws. And that's the only question that Section 12406 is interested in. And the fact that Portland is a sanctuary state may limit
the city,
to the ability of Portland to cooperate with ICE but there's no need to cooperate with ICE in order to maintain the public peace.
So do the conservatives that I guess have overtaken a dominant liberal majority in the Ninth Circuit, do they rely on just the interpretation of the Insurrection Act that gives the president of the U.S. a lot of latitude for his own subjective judgment? I mean, what is the basis of their reading of this act in favor of the Trump administration?
Well, the majority says that the president has the power to do this, that the judiciary does have the power to review it, but if the president's actions can be in any way justified, or if it's within the bounds of possible reason, they have to support it. So they basically say the standard is very forgiving for the president, and that this standard has been met. That's the present ruling. The guy who concurred argued that the president doesn't have to meet any standard at all.
Whoa. And
so there is a case that's going to be ahead of the Oregon case. California, there's a Newsom v. Trump case that is going to be argued this month after the reviews of bench trial where a federal judge ruled in August that Trump's deployment of the California National Guard in Los Angeles violated the Posse Comitatus Act. So that ruling was cited repeatedly by both the majority and dissent in the case reviewing the Portland situation.
And go ahead, finish. I wanted to also turn to the implications of these cases for the actions of protesters at ICE facilities. Do you want to finish a point there? Or?
Well, I forgot what it was.
About that this is still an important case in California.
Right, and that case will likely trump our case, to make a bad pun, in that it was a few months ahead of it. But it's very different factually, because in Los Angeles is huge. In Southern California in its entirety, it was invaded by 4,000 National Guard troops, a third of all the troops available, as compared with 200 troops in Portland. And everyone agrees the only locus of concern in Portland is the ICE facility in the southwest part of Portland. And so it's factually very different.
So speaking of the ICE facility, on No King's Day here in Portland, protesters were tear gassed and pepper sprayed at the ICE facility. And so you have this kind of split screen of Portland ICE protests of, on the one side of the screen, playful frogs and inflated animal costumes kind of mocking the whole specter of insurrection and mayhem in Portland. And on the other side of the screen, you do have real confrontations between ICE agents and protesters that kind of ebb and flow. What are the implications of these cases and opinions going through the courts for tactics of resistance at ICE facilities?
Well, I think the whimsical and mocking protest was aimed at Trump himself, who refers to Portland as a hellhole in general. And
can't see why anyone could possibly live here.
I know. But of course, that's very different than what's going on where ICE lives and where its office is. And those protests what you described shows that there is no problem with law enforcement right now. Law enforcement can enforce the law. It can even abuse the laws. There's plenty of muscle, plenty of personnel right now without any National Guard troops. There's absolutely no need. There's no present inability to enforce the law that is required by the federal law cited by Trump. So the reach of the First Amendment is always in dispute. It always will be. There will be abuses. There will be excesses. That's part of expression. That's part of knowing and measuring accurately what people feel and how strongly do they feel it, in what ways do they feel it, in what ways are they moved to action. That's part of this country's fundamental way of presenting and resolving disputes.
So, Mike, I wanted to ask you about the case that is put together in opposition to the Trumpistas, as you call them, that these are just a handful of people in lawn chairs and a lot of old people who are quite benign. And is there a risk of accepting that premise that we're only able to defend ourselves if we're small and helpless and benign and don't engage in confrontational tactics? Is there a risk in accepting that premise?
No, because this is a review of the actual facts on the ground in Portland. That's what the law requires. Are the authorities presently unable to obey the law? And all of that, those facts that you just described, are the real facts on the ground and have been for months for the most part. So the fact that they were noted by the dissent is entirely irrelevant to this particular case. Every case will be resolved on its own facts. The Los Angeles case is a very different case. But the facts cited here by the dissent that you just cited are in reality what's going on. And that controls what legal responses are allowed.
So as the Trump administration continues with its reactionary, aggressive, fascistic moves and use of ICE agents and the protests gathering momentum, what are the legal issues there that may differ from what's been happening in recent months?
I think Judge Graber is optimistic that the Ninth Circuit, in its larger version, will ban the present efforts. But I'm concerned that the U.S. Supreme Court, which will eventually resolve this question of how far does the president's reach extend, it'll have cases from Chicago, from California, and from Oregon. They'll all be a little bit different. They will be resolved by the U.S. Supreme Court. And I'm afraid that what that court will do will be to reserve to the judiciary a sort of formal degree of power, but it will find what the president does to be well within the reach of his discretion, and that he can basically do what he wants to do. At that point, we will have a government which, unlike the 60s, which in many ways were more violent, is not isolated to hippies and black people, but he's demonizing all Democrats. His press secretary says they're all agents of Hamas. So in my mind, that makes the upcoming election supremely important. First, to make sure that it actually happens, and then to make sure that the process is properly followed. I think if so, that Trump has alienated enough of his own base with his lurches, economically speaking, with tariffs from 200% to 12%, with his deals made to benefit people who hold Argentinian bonds by giving billions of dollars to Argentina, which at the same time Argentina is selling all of its soybeans and beef to China and are depriving the U.S. of many markets to which ranchers and farmers have long since been accustomed to selling into. But there's enough problems emerging that if we have a fair election, I think Trump will be gone in terms of the House of Representatives. That will be enough anyway, because they do create the budgets. So it's a remarkably strong, bitter battle going on now between not just a silent majority and extreme hippies and black people, but between one huge group of people and another huge group of people in this country.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you, Mike, for that little tutorial on the law, very old laws that get resurrected, and on both sides of this struggle. And we'll continue to follow these court cases, and we'll keep the words of Judge Susan Graber in mind as we continue to look to the law as a very complicated process, but we still need to turn to the law where we can.
I think so, and I will answer Judge Graber's statement, that request or appeal, that those of us who are watching this case unfold retain faith in our judicial system for just a little longer. I will do that for just a little longer.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. We'll see you next month.
That was Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discussing the legal disputes over Trump's attempt to send federalized National Guard troops into cities. And before that, a clip from the KBOO Evening News about events at the Portland ICE facility on October 18th. We also heard clips from the anti-fascist anthem, Bella Ciao, performed by Chumbawamba and by the J Terrestrial Fire Pit Collective. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle, and we go now to another story about the value of turning to law where we can. In this case, it's about bringing the city into compliance with international law against genocide. We'll hear a conversation between Laurie Mercier and Olivia Catby, followed by excerpts from the October 17th press conference hosted by Catby and including some of the Portland City Councilors involved.
Good morning. I'm speaking with Olivia Catby, co-chair of Portland Democratic Socialists of America, and a longtime advocate for justice in Palestine and activist with the BDS movement. Welcome to KBOO, Olivia.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we want to talk about the history-making event of last Friday, October 17th, when half of Portland's city councilors announced that they have signed on to a national pledge to investigate any city economic and infrastructural connection to weapon shipments or other complicity with Israel's genocide of Palestinians. And they're calling on city officials across the nation to make the same commitment. Can you tell us something about the context for this pledge? How and why DSA and some city councilors believe it important to examine city investments and what they're funding?
Yeah, absolutely. So the United States is Israel's number one partner in genocide. The weapons and the funding come from the United States, which has spent over $31 billion in the last 2 years alone in support of Israel's genocide. And Congress has really refused to act on this. Every single attempt at reining in military funding or weapons transfers to Israel in Congress has failed by a large margin. And, you know, there is some improvement in this area recently with the Block the Bombs Act, but it's not enough. And we know that the weapons and the equipment for Israel are by and large coming from the U.S., meaning the manufacturing and transport of those weapons and equipment is happening in U.S. cities. So the idea is for cities to take action to enact a sort of municipal arms embargo in whatever way they can. So whether that be investigating what is going in and out of the ports, trying to pressure the port authority, whether it's pressuring or divesting from corporations who are producing these weapons, whether it's, you know, simply ending diplomatic ties with the Israeli government, such as sister city relationships, which we have in Portland. These are things that can be done at the city level. And I think you can kind of think of it as similar to the sanctuary city movement, you know, where cities are really trying to do whatever they have the power to do at the city level to stop something that is really the result of federal policy. But cities do have some power to not cooperate. And I think having our new city councilors has been a great opportunity to do something like this because they are so brave. And as Councillor Murillo mentioned during the press conference, because we have this new form of government, they are not beholden to PACs or to corporate interests the way that their predecessors were. They were elected to serve the people, and the vast majority of people across party lines support an arms embargo on Israel. National polling has shown us that is the case. And so we thought this was a really good opportunity for our DSA councilors to show leadership on this issue nationally.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like I think 92% of people who consider themselves Democrats are opposed to sending any more weapons to Israel, and even a majority of Republicans. So clearly this is a majority issue for the population, and it's a matter of pulling leadership along. And so we're lucky to have this new Portland City Council that's willing to take a look at these connections between the local and international. Now, you've been involved in the boycott, divestment, sanctions, or BDS movement for years. Can you say something about its origins in relation to Israel and in relationship to the BDS movement that helped end apartheid in South Africa.
Yeah, absolutely. The BDS movement stands for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. And it's a nonviolent movement that was founded in 2005 by the largest coalition of Palestinian civil society. And it's a movement that calls on the international community to engage in boycotts, divestment, and sanctions on Israel to pressure Israel to comply with international law. And this, like you mentioned, was really inspired by the South African anti-apartheid movement, where massive boycotts and divestment eventually led to government sanctions on South Africa, which helped create the pressure that led to the fall of apartheid. I think it's important to remember that the genocide of the past 2 years did not happen in a vacuum. It is a continuation of the past 77 plus years of Israel's ethnic cleansing of indigenous Palestinians. And the BDS movement, it has existed for 20 years. And in that time, we've seen a lot of momentum. We're now at the point where over 52 countries have called for or implemented some form of arms embargo. Some countries have enacted other forms of sanctions, such as suspending trade agreements with Israel or suspending Israel's participation in international bodies. We've seen massive divestment, billions of dollars divested from Israel and complicit companies, from churches, unions, and other pension funds that have divested. We've seen major artists and celebrities and cultural institutions boycott Israel. Multinational companies have withdrawn their business from Israel completely due to BDS pressure. And what this is all building towards, hopefully, is sanctions globally, and especially from the United States. And the primary sanction that we really need to see right now is an arms embargo. If the United States was not sending the weapons, Israel would not be able to commit genocide. That's a fact. The flow of weapons starts with us, and it has to end with us. And the rest of the world is really waiting on us to act to end this. And so that's why I'm very excited that our counselors are taking this up.
Yeah, and it's also exciting that this is going to be a national effort, given the fact that, as you point out, the United States is still resisting acknowledging this genocide and continuing to prop up Israel and its horrific war and supporting its war crimes. And even though the rest of the world has been turning against Israel and trying to coax the United States to join that effort, there is this resistance. So I think it's a great idea to kind of focus on the local, given the fact that at the national level, there's not this same kind of movement. I have heard some local news outlets and individuals question why the city council should be involved in this so-called international issue, trying to divorce the connections between the social needs of cities like Portland from the military industrial complex supporting mm-hmm. Israel. And can you explain what those connections are? I mean, we're going to listen to some of the comments in a little bit on the Old Mole show from the counselors themselves, but could you explain what those connections are between the local and the international?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that was a question we got at the press conference that we held last week, was how can Portland city councilors be focusing on this so-called international issue when we have so many needs in our city right now? And I want to reiterate that the United States spent $31 billion in support of Israel's genocide just in the last 2 years. And at the same time, at the city level, all we are hearing is budget cuts, budget cuts, budget cuts, $100 million deficit in the city budget. We might have to close community centers every single year. It is not adding up. We have enough resources to fund the things we need and to make our city great. But to redistribute those funds at the federal level to spend on community and care rather than violence and death, that's going to take an immense amount of pressure from below, from communities and from workers and from city governments themselves, if they're willing to. And our counselors are willing to. And that's sort of what we are hoping to provide an opportunity for city counselors to do nationally.
Well, what can listeners and Portlanders do to support these counselors who have endorsed the pledge? And we will link on the Old Mole Variety Hour website, we'll link to the press conference and the call for, or the pledge itself, and a call for supporting that pledge. But what can people listening do to support our city counselors who are endorsing the pledge and trying to investigate whether there are connections in Portland, mm-hmm. Portland's investments?
Yeah, I would say send a thank you email or a thank you phone call to the counselors that signed on. So our four DSA member city counselors launched this, but then we also had two more counselors join. So it's counselors Tiffany Koyama-Lane, Samir Kanal, Mitch Green, Angelita Murillo, Candace Avalos, and Jamie Dunphy. They all signed on, and they need to hear that you appreciate it because they are facing backlash. And then also contacting the other six counselors, asking them to sign and stating why it's important to do something like this at the city level. Portland is setting an example for the entire country as a progressive city, and we have the opportunity to be bold and to lead at a time when there's a crisis of leadership right now. I think also if you have information, if you know of weapons companies or companies that are shipping parts to Israel, if you know of, you know, if you have information about the port of Portland and what's going on there, send it to our counselors because I think they would like the research support. I think we should implore all of our counselors to live up to their stated values and to lead on this issue, to say no to complicity and genocide.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Olivia Catby, and we really appreciate all the work that you've been doing. This is really important work and kind of a milestone for the Portland City Council. And so we want to encourage listeners to support this effort. And we're going to play some excerpts from last week's press conference featuring the counselors Samir Kanal, Mitch Green, Angelita Murillo, and Tiffany Koyama-Lane in just a few minutes. So thanks again, Olivia.
Thank you for having me. Counselor Samir Kanal.
Last month, the United Nations Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the occupied Palestinian territory confirmed the findings of every major humanitarian organization in the world, including the Israeli organizations B'Tselem and Physicians for Human Rights Israel, and reported that Israel was carrying out a genocide in Gaza. The UN Commission also said that corporate entities have profited from the Israeli economy, including illegal occupation, apartheid, and now genocide. Ending these crimes will not happen without holding the private sector accountable. Even in Donald Trump's world, international law matters. These laws convey an obligation to governments and corporations to act in the face of injustice. With this pledge today, we are doing our part to meet this obligation. I want to address a question I've heard since this press conference was announced, which is why now? Why after the ceasefire was declared? I want to recognize the hopes of billions of people around the world that these atrocities would end with the ceasefire and that it seemed that these hopes were achieved. We also know that within hours of the ceasefire being announced, the Israeli military was shooting at civilians returning to their homes in violation of the ceasefire. We also know that violence is continuing in the West Bank as well. I want to recognize the hundreds, then thousands, then tens of thousands of Portlanders who have raised their voices in support of human rights in the region. I particularly want to recognize the Palestinian American Portlanders who spoke up at a time of great fear for their community, a time of vulnerability, and a time of immense grief. You deserve to live without fear, not only here in Portland, but around the world. And I want to acknowledge as well the millions of Jewish Americans, including many right here in Portland, who've spoken out at a time that is also a great fear for their community. This activism is in line with the historical commitments and sacrifices of Jewish communities around the world in support of civil and human rights, which date back not just decades, but centuries. Our struggles are connected, and the fight for Palestinian human rights and Palestinian life is connected with the struggles against all forms of discrimination and hatred, including racism, sexism, homophobia, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, and more, as well as a struggle against authoritarianism here in America, such as the threat of military invasion of Portland. Portland prides itself on its values of inclusion, kindness, justice, and accountability. We see that in the way our city is showing up right now to say that Donald Trump's occupation of our streets is wrong. And my goal as a counselor is to make sure our policies line up with our values. And that's why I'm signing today. Thank you.
Next, we are going to hear from Counselor Mitch Green.
Good afternoon. I'm Mitch Green. I'm a Portland City Councilor for District 4 and a U.S. Army veteran. I'm participating in this action today because it's clear to me that the war in Gaza is not just some distant conflict. It is connected to us, to our city, our economy, and our own struggle for democracy right here in Portland. I have seen firsthand the damage caused by weapons of war, and I know the surveillance and military technologies used abroad always come home for use in our own communities. We're seeing this in real time. The logic that labels every Palestinian man, woman, and child as a terrorist to justify their death is the same logic that President Trump uses to label those of us in Portland who oppose fascism as terrorists, and to justify sending in federal agents and the National Guard. The goal is the same, to silence dissent and crush resistance. That's why it is my obligation as a Portlander to think about how our city is involved in these networks of violence. We cannot stand by while our public resources and our tax dollars are used to fuel atrocities abroad that in turn fuel the militarization on our own streets. I am proud today to add my name to this pledge and to begin the process of investigating and eventually ending our city's ties to the ongoing atrocities being committed in Palestine. We have called this press conference to launch a nationwide pledge for city councilors to investigate the manufacture and transport of weapons and military equipment for Israel happening within our city limits, as well as any other form of complicity in Israel's crimes at the city level. Where Congress has failed, cities must lead. I plan to use the power of my office to determine the extent of our economic and material ties to the weapons and surveillance technologies used in Gaza. If the supply chain of any of these items flows through Portland, I want to know about it. Portland has a choice. We can sit idly by as genocide is carried out with our weapons and our dollars and wait for our turn in the crosshairs, or we can be a city that stands on the side of humanity and says, not in our name. We can begin to build a world where our economy is rooted in care for others. To my colleagues in city governments across the country, we are not powerless. Join us in this pledge. Let us use the tools we have to stop the flow of weapons, to stand against fascism and military occupation everywhere it rears its ugly head, and to build a world where every life is valued, from Palestine to Portland. Thank you.
Next, we are going to hear from Councillor Angelita Murillo.
I want to speak on this issue a little bit differently than my colleagues. I want to speak about this specifically as an immigrant on city council who is facing this political moment right now. And I just want to say that the connections between what we are seeing in Gaza and what we are seeing from ICE and the federal government are absolutely clear to me. Palestinians who are held on administrative detention without due process is exactly the same as what they are doing to immigrants in our communities here who are being kidnapped off of our streets, who have their due process taken away, and who are being separated from their families. And I think it's incredibly encouraging that the discourse around this has changed. It's encouraging that 50 members of the U.S. House of Representatives have signed on to legislation to block certain weapons shipments to Israel, and that this is never going to be enough. As city officials, we have to step in where Congress has failed. And there are certain days where I wonder what power we have as local leaders to make sure that this stops. And at the end of the day, I have finally rested on the thought that no matter how small an action is, that it's important that we do it anyways, because it is all of our collective actions together that are going to make a difference. So as city officials, we do have power, and we have a responsibility to wield that power in support of our constituents who are fighting for Palestine, in support of Palestinians in our districts, in support of the people who are flying in to get medical treatment in our city because of the bombings that they have endured with our tax dollars. The fragile ceasefire that went into effect last week, it does not change our city's obligation to comply with international law. Israel has already violated that ceasefire by killing Palestinians attempting to return to their homes, and Trump has said that he can call it off at a moment's notice. The time for a ceasefire was 77 years ago during the first Nakba. Now, things have shifted. The demands are stronger because what Palestinian people are facing is harder than ever. And if we don't do our part right now, then I fear that we are going to lose an entire people in this moment. I also want to point out that as an immigrant, all of the technologies that are being used on immigrants here right now and on people who are protesting to protect immigrants were tested on Palestinians first. According to an article that was published by The Guardian on September 2nd, ICE is using that same surveillance technology here now. They purchased that surveillance technology and they are planning on using it against our people if they already haven't. And so the terror that our tax dollars inflict abroad gets imported back home against our own people. And I inherently always firmly believe that our liberation is tied together. So when we abandon the Palestinian people, we're also abandoning people like me, Paraguayan immigrants, people who are depending on us to fight on all fronts for our liberation. So part of my commitment here today is to ensure that these tools cannot hurt Portlanders. And that starts off with this pledge. This pledge to me is for Marwa and Nasser, a Palestinian mother and son who I got to greet in the Portland airport when they came in last year. They needed emergency medical assistance because of the bombings that they endured. And I think about Nasser, the little boy, every day because he was holding his Star Wars toy in one arm and he had lost his other arm due to the bombings. This pledge is for him. This pledge is for the brave Portlanders who went on the flotilla to deliver food and aid to the starving people of Gaza who were never able to make it. And this pledge is for everyone whose hearts remain steadfast in the belief that all human beings deserve dignity and freedom. And I know that there are a lot more of us who believe in that than there are people who think that this is okay. So thank you to everyone for being here today. I'm really honored to sign this pledge, and I hope that the rest of my colleagues will join us.
There's a question. How do you plan to act on this pledge? What are the next steps? Councillor Green, go ahead. Oh, and then Councillor Murillo.
Yeah, I won't speak for everyone, but in terms of my office, I think it's really important to kind of do our due diligence and homework first inside of our offices to say, okay, what do we see? What have we heard from our constituents? We have invested a lot in our capabilities to do economic and sort of industrial analysis research. And so when we look at the supply chain aspect of how Portland is situated in terms of the potential material complicity in the region, we're going to bring forward that as a basis to say, okay, are we also investing? Or are we providing sort of tax breaks or material supports? Does our own investment policy enable or support this sort of thing? So that's how I intend to start this work, and then use my office in its legislative capacity to bring things forward.
Thank you, Councillor Green. And I just wanted to add, yeah, I think that the city of Portland has a responsibility to look at, from a humanitarian perspective, where all of our investments go. So this is going to be, in my opinion, a longstanding policy and analysis on whether or not our city is contracting and profiting with companies that are harming people abroad, whether that be Palestinians or people in the Congo or anywhere else, right? So we have a duty and responsibility to ensure that our dollars are being used responsibly. I also think that now as electeds, we are in a position of talking to our colleagues and making sure that they understand and meet this political moment. Because as we all know, you need at least 7 out of 12 votes to pass policy at the city of Portland. So we need our colleagues to step up and to be brave in this moment too, so that we can do right by Portlanders and the people who are standing up for our neighbors here at home and abroad.
Here's a question. Councillors, Portland is struggling with addiction, homelessness, untreated mental illness, failing infrastructure, and a growing budget deficit. How do you justify spending the time and political capital of city leadership on a symbolic foreign policy pledge when so many urgent crises here at home remain unresolved? Shouldn't Portlanders expect their elected officials to focus on fixing Portland before pledging resources to investigate international conflicts? And I will go to Councillor Green and then Councillor Canall.
It's a reasonable question to ask. And I would say that we're in this situation because we elected at all levels have been too cowardly, frankly, to stand up against this complicity and fueling a war machine. And so by taking action at the local level, we can create a political mandate that then translates into our federal electeds doing their job, which is to check this administration and making sure that we're not spending money on ICE, we're not spending money on DHS and sending billions of dollars overseas to kill brown people overseas, and then instead invest in infrastructure back home. That's only going to change if we can create our conditions of political action from the ground up. And I'll stand by that.
Thank you. Councillor Canall?
Yeah. Can you imagine what the impact of these dollars would be if they were invested in Salt and Straw or invested in all of the other types of local businesses that we see come up here? If they were invested in social housing and the revolving loan fund that we've been talking about, when we send our dollars outside of city limits ever, it's a way of helping boost whatever we're investing in. And when we bring those dollars home, we're helping Portland businesses, we're helping revive our economy, we're helping continue the trend that we're already on as a city to move forward, in addition to all the moral implications associated with it, in addition to ensuring that we don't have complicity in the negative consequences of those investments, we're also boosting the incredible work that is being done in our private sector or in the public sector, depending on how we invest those dollars locally. And so I'm really grateful for the opportunity opportunity to talk about this, because it's your tax dollars as Portlanders that we are putting into these investments. And we should be investing back in the communities that are putting money in. Thanks.
Councillor Morio. I think my two colleagues covered all of it. The only thing I'll add is that when I was in DC a few months ago, lobbying on behalf of Portland for our transportation infrastructure, we were going to the federal government and begging them to give us money to do basic things like maintain our bridges for earthquake safety or have road repairs or all of the things that people regularly ask us for. I just want to agree with Councillor Canall that every dollar that is going towards bombing and maiming innocent people abroad is a dollar that is not being spent on our infrastructure here at home. And so I think that we have a moral and a financial responsibility to ensure that we are using our dollars to actually just make the world better. We have so much money and we can. And for some reason, these are the choices that our congressional delegation has made.
Councillor Coyama-Lane.
Thank you. Yeah, the thing that I'll add is just, we know that some of the same companies and technologies that are causing devastation in Gaza are also being used on Portlanders, specifically immigrants and refugees and people peacefully protesting. So this is something that is connected to what's going on in our own neighborhoods.
What would you say to other city councilors or officials who are on the fence about pledging to investigate local complicity? I imagine that there are lots of councilors who in their heart feel that they want to support this, but they feel scared of the backlash they might receive. What would you say to them? Angelita?
Thank you. We are elected officials. It is our responsibility to step up to the moment. And I think that there is that common saying, one day everyone will have been against this. We do not need to wait for that moment later. I don't want to look at my nieces when they're adults and they ask me what I did in that political moment. I want to be able to look them in the face and tell them that before it was politically popular, that I stood up and I did the right thing. I also have to say, especially for our city council members, we have ranked choice voting. We have small donor elections. We are not beholden to PACs or to power in the way that our predecessors were before us. We actually have the opportunity to represent people in the most moral and honest way that we can, and we should step up to this moment. So thank you.
Thank you. Councillor Canall.
Thanks. Yeah, I'll speak more to those who are outside of Portland and around the country. You will not be alone, both because you'll have colleagues and city councils around the country like us who have signed on to a pledge like this, but also because you will find that there are millions of people in this country who've been waiting for you to take this stand, and they're not necessarily the people in every city who are coming to city council meetings, coming to city hall. There are a lot of people who've given up on government because government has not been responsive to the people on issues related to human rights in general or related to Palestine specifically. So I would say trust in your communities, trust in the people of whatever city you represent, and you will find that you are not alone, you are supported.
Thank you. Councillor Green?
Just want to echo and emphasize what Councillors Murillo and Canall have already said, and I'll just note that we have these jobs not as sort of a career ladder to somewhere better, but because we're in a place of service. And if you ran on human rights and if you ran on this idea of being responsive to your constituency, that's your obligation, come what may. And it's actually politically popular to stand up and speak out against genocide and to use your tools. That's what people want. People are desperate right now in our country to say, what are you doing to stop this machine, whether we're talking about deportations or a genocide in Gaza? And so I think you'll find that you have a base of support behind you in that. And so you may get an angry letter from one place, but you're going to get 10 from another group of people who have been waiting for you to speak out.
You have been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle, and we've been listening to some clips from Bella Ciao, performed by Palestinian artists and those in solidarity, including Tara, Penny Stone, and the Freedom Flotilla Collective. We heard some clips from the October 17th press conference about city councilors' pledge to investigate Portland's possible complicity with Israel's illegal occupation and genocidal violence against Palestinians, as well as a discussion between Laurie Mercier and Olivia Catby about that pledge. Thanks so much to CAPI and to the Portland City Councilors who have signed on, and to all those working for justice, freedom, and peace. Thanks to Laurie Mercier for bringing us that audio, and thanks to Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker for their Left in the Law discussion of legal wrangling about sending federalized troops to Portland. And thanks to Anna Wilcox and the rest of the KABU News team for reporting on events at the McAdam Ice Building. You can visit the webpage for this episode at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour to find links to thank the city councilors who've signed on to resist complicity with genocide. To find out more about Thursday's event about breaking the silence on medicide in Gaza, and to find out more about all our segments. While you're there, you can click on the red donate tab in the upper right corner to support KABU. You can also support your volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit community radio station by texting KBOO to 44321 or by mailing a check to KABU at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thanks so much to all of KABU's members and listeners and volunteers and staff. We'll go out with more Bella Ciao.
Boogie Cat, meow, meow. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communication Act of 1934.